Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grainne Reid, Head of Marketing at ExchangeWire, and your host for today. Joining me is Ellie McDonough, Programmatic Director at Dentsu. Ellie, it's great to have you here, especially fresh off the stage from ATS London earlier this month.
Bit of a media tour for me.
Alongside Ellie, we've got Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire. How are you, Rachel?
Very well, thank you, G.
Great. Well, today we're going to be diving into three major news stories that are making headlines this week. Donald Trump claims Lachlan Murdoch and Rupert Murdoch may invest in the TikTok deal. A third of independent publishers could face closure next year as AI search impacts traffic. And UK broadcast leaders from BBC, ITV, Paramount and Channel 4 downplay merger speculation, saying, "I'm not sure that's good for the UK." So let's dive into it. And first up, President Trump has suggested that the US has agreed a deal with Chinese-owned ByteDance to keep TikTok operating in the US. Trump told Fox News on Sunday that Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan are probably going to be involved, as well as Oracle Executive Chairman Larry Ellison and Dell Technologies CEO Michael Dell. Ellie, what could the news of this US ownership of TikTok mean for the social media landscape?
I think there's so many different ways that it could go, and there's probably a lot of changes that could come, but I think this will probably propel TikTok to go more in the direction that we've seen these other big kind of platforms so far. So the way that we have e-commerce transforming across Meta properties, the way that we have their kind of messaging capabilities also across the Meta properties, including like WhatsApp and stuff, not necessarily a social platform, but those kinds of, ways that we use social has just kind of continued and evolved. And I think that's where TikTok, even from a consumer perspective, I feel like it is definitely got kind of all those areas that you turn to it for engagement, for entertainment, for knowledge. But when it comes to that increasing the connection, you've kind of got that live stream and you've got instant like DM messages. And I feel like you might not have that same kind of collaboration and the way that you can engage that we see across other platforms. And then when we think about TikTok Shop, we like obviously have seen that kind of increase, and that's something that we're seeing more and more of from brands kind of turning to. But I think that with other these platforms that are typically currently owned by a lot of these billionaires in America, things like Amazon have kind of, changed the way that we have shopped, and TikTok is already tapping into that. So I think that's even going to be something that we see more and more of, and the way that brands use that as well.
Rachel, what are your thoughts?
So that's super interesting because I suppose if you think about what TikTok was even maybe 3-4 years ago, it was much more short form video platform, full stop, really. So not quite the same social media landscape as some of those other big incumbents that you mentioned. So you're right, really, that this is probably a nod to it becoming more of, if you like, a modern media business, which quite frankly means a social media platform. So it's definitely, I think, a strong likelihood that it will extend all of its capabilities and get into all of those areas in order to compete with Amazon, Meta and other platforms. I think that the kind of proposed ownership structure is super interesting. Firstly, I've got no idea how they managed to get the Chinese to agree to that, number one. Number two, it's kind of a who's who of big corporate American companies. And then number three, the Murdochs, like, hilarious. What is this, like a little spin-off of Succession or something? I found that really super surprising. So then that made me think, well, then what does that do to TikTok US as a business? ByteDance only retained 20% stake in it. So it's sort of not at all the same type of platform that it originally was. That's to be expected anyway, because the world of our digital consumption moves on so quickly. And like you say, Ellie, there's so much opportunity for it to expand as a platform into more of a social media play. But I also think that, it's no longer a replica of how ByteDance operate their business in China and elsewhere in Asia. It is an American, US kind of globalized company. So it's going to look really different from here onwards, I think.
And why do you think the Murdochs have such an interest in this?
I mean, I feel like they're trying to find, they had such a stake in the game back in, well, I don't want to say the 70s, but was it the 70s?
I mean, like, it's a really 70s, good question, 80s? Actually. Yeah, it's like, a really good question. Like, I think, you know, here we are, two Australians, and we've got no real idea of the dates associated with the Murdoch Empire. But I feel like it was probably 70s, 80s that they really started to acquire international media properties and became very aggressive in the US.
They know that landscape really well. And I think, like, when we're talking about some of the other topics today, I think that also ties in because their family has historically been kind of, you know, embedded in that media, you know, property landscape. And I think when it comes to the changes that we're seeing, TikTok is one to kind of really invest in because you can kind of have, you can see where the trends are progressing and the way that people consume naturally aligns to that as well.
Yeah. I think it might have been a political manoeuvre too, to some extent. Like, if you're Donald Trump and you're suddenly, well, not suddenly, I mean, he does loads of things suddenly, so I don't think he really cares about this, but if you're kind of moving your position from, you know, during his first administration, very anti-China, very anti-big tech, and you're now in your second administration, you've come in on this whole mandate of implementing tariffs and making sure that the US isn't getting pushed around by other global superpowers, i.e. China. And one of your big things, one of your big platforms was let's ban TikTok, but now actually lots of other people are suggesting you should try to make a way to stack this up. Then what are you going to do? You're going to try to get institutional American investors and companies and media businesses behind you to make it palatable for you know, the US political landscape. And that is so, because also that sort of roster of US companies that are going to support it, Oracle, Dell, Andreessen Horowitz, these are really sort of quite conservative institutional American companies. Who else could you add to that roster? Who else could you get on your side that's going to make conservative voters especially feel comfortable? Rupert Murdoch and the rest of his clan.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it is pretty wild.
Yeah.
And also it's not over yet, right?
Like, no.
You know, it hasn't been finalised, so I'm sure there's going to be a few more twists and turns.
Definitely. We're going to see a lot more, definitely. But do you think we're going to then see the TikTok app look very different to users?
I think there might be some change in kind of what we see on there. We've already seen kind of like a lot of different ways. It was a, you know, an app that we primarily were watching people dance. We were seeing, you know, all these people kind of recreate different trends and stuff. And now it is like I'm learning how to, you know, knit on TikTok. I like go there for recipes. There's so many different ways to consume. And we've seen things like YouTube be something that was, you know, primarily such a UGC and like low quality kind of platform, and now having like full blown documentaries. They've got, you know, really high quality content on there. And TikTok has started to step, like definitely has gone in that same direction. But it's now thinking about how, I think, how they extend that content. Where else are they kind of, are they going to move towards having like a connected like TV approach where you can have the app embedded? Is there other things that are going to come into the fold? Because you can, you know, tilt your screen across and then you can have that, you know, different way of consuming. So what I think will change mostly for consumers outside of, you know, the different kind of like shopping experiences, messaging experiences that we're seeing across other the big players, I think the way that people are creating content for TikTok, I think, will be even more stronger.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I'm not a TikTok user just because I am old and I tend to only use these things when, I don't know, it's unavoidable. It's not, and it's not even a personal opinion. It's like whatever platform I need to be on to find stuff that I want to find stuff is where I'll go. But if you think about how the TikTok, you know, sort of video format then started to influence how other platforms show their videos. So really, I'm spending my time on Instagram doing exactly what you're doing on TikTok. So it's only a matter of time before I'm also doing that on TikTok. So it's already changed a lot, and it's also changed how other platforms are operating. And I think you're right. If you think about as a business, where's TikTok going to grow in terms of revenue opportunities, content opportunities, you know, monetizing their content and inventory for advertisers or shoppable environments, they're only going to do what everybody else is doing, and they're going to try to go into those parts of the media landscape where we're starting to see growth or where we're really seeing growth, and that's got to be, you know, CTV. And, Yeah, who knows what else? I mean, I'm thinking also about how audio channels are becoming so mashed up with video channels as well. You know, I'm watching podcasts. That's one of the reasons why we're filming this podcast.
Exactly.
And weirdly, I'm watching podcasts. This is really weird. Again, this is such an indication of what an old fogey I am, but I'm watching podcasts on Spotify because that's where I get all my audio content. So I'm not watching them on YouTube or another platform, but I will. I absolutely will, as long as that's available.
Well, I post TikToks just of random things that I get up to, nothing that's actually of any kind of quality. And the way that I can see the creator insights, and I've got no following compared to all of these other people that are out there, the way that you can see the power that you can have on an app like that, I think, is already quite powerful. And I think that can only get even stronger when we have these kind of changes coming to the landscape. Like, the way that you can monetize is really interesting. People will list like their songs and you can kind of choose to put them on your video and get paid to do that in different ways. You can see like all the kind of typical, you know, media insights that you would get from like, a campaign with a media owner. We're getting that in TikTok as a creator. Well, I'm not even a creator, but like you can see that in your dashboard. So I think it's giving a lot of power to people that want to create content, and they'll be able to do it a lot better, I think, with the changes that might be coming.
It's really interesting. Mm. And yeah, let's see what unfolds here. Mm. Yeah. While big names obviously have been circling the TikTok future, the outlook is far less certain for independent publishers, many of whom are now facing extinction as AI-driven search reshapes the digital landscape. A board member of the Independent Publishers Alliance has warned that one third of its publishers could be out of business by the end of next year if no regulatory intervention is made to protect publishers as AI search surges and becomes the new norm. If the situation remains as it is, it's estimated that 100 of the 300 websites owned by Independent Publishers Alliance members are unlikely to survive in the next 12 months. Ellie, what are the best ways that publishers could be adapting to the change that's seen in the landscape at the moment?
Yeah, I read something the other day that was like, we need to stop, obviously not stop thinking about SEO, but we need to start thinking about AEO, agentic engine optimization. So how, you know, AI agents and the different kind of scraping tools that are out there are finding that content. And sometimes when you go on ChatGPT, a lot of the sources are from Reddit, from, you know, other big, you know, news sites that you could probably name off the top of your hand. They're not necessarily going into these small independents. And I think what we need to do is to kind of protect journalism in a way as well. So it's not just making sure they're still, you know, able to kind of exist and operate. We still need to actually have different ways of journalism coming into the media. I think what would be a good solution is to, you know, they're already kind of connected all together, but working with these different AI companies and the different like partners that are in market, building out these scraping tools, building out these kinds of, I guess, ways to analyze what is being pushed out there. And then being able to help kind of connect in, fuel their research, fuel their, like, not necessarily funding, but how they kind of operate, I think will help to kind of build a bit more involvement for those independent publishers to maintain at least some kind of involvement in that progressing. Otherwise, if we just are allowing all these different AI partners and tools to find it on their own, the independents will just kind of be left behind.
Anything to add, Rachel?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously at ExchangeWire, we have always been huge supporters of journalist-led publications and content, and feel very strongly that part and parcel of the advertising industry is a responsibility to protect that, you know. And we've always talked about how the internet has been comprised of a lot of free-to-access content, but it's advertising that pays for that. It's advertising that makes that possible. Of course, AI-driven search is upending that to some extent, but the sort of monetization model for publishers had already become quite complex, you know, from the moment that the internet was invented, quite frankly, and as digital advertising has only become more and more sophisticated, because a couple of things have happened, right? arguably it's given publishers perhaps more of an opportunity to monetize their inventory if they can get that advertising piece right. And that's what we spend a lot of time talking about in the world of ad tech and martech, is how do you enable publishers to successfully monetize their inventory? How do you enable them to offer up their valuable audiences to advertisers, you know, in a way that can be measurable and can really, you know, achieve some good quality outcomes? And we spend lots of time talking about that technical integration that that enables that, how good it is, what needs to change, etc. But I think the other side of the coin is very much focused on consumer behaviour. So the protection of independent publishers has also got something to do with the way consumers are digesting information and finding information. So how are they searching for it? How are they interrogating that information and understanding it? You know, how do they do that, understand the sources that it's coming from? Do they, you know, do they feel confident in those sources? And then crucially, how is it being paid for? How are they paying for it, or how is it being paid for? So I think, you know, the world, the, you know, consumers' experience with online content has moved on to a much more sophisticated point now, where I don't think it would be a shocking conversation to have with the average person that's got no idea about, you know, the world of digital advertising, to get them to think about, well, you know, if you're consuming lots of content free, how do you think that content's actually being pulled together and who's actually paying for it? And I think they'd be able to pretty easily understand, oh yeah, okay, well, that's why advertising is important, or that's why, you know, a donation to The Guardian or a subscription to, you know, The Independent is important. But AI search takes it to another level. And I think what we then need to do is, as not just as not just within our industry, as a group of professionals and colleagues trying to elevate these issues and trying to think about strategically how we should approach them as an industry, but I also think consumers need to move along with this too, and everybody needs to be constantly asking themselves the question, where am I getting my information from and who's paying for it? That means, am I paying for it? And if I'm not paying for it, if I am, who am I paying? Am I paying a publisher directly, or am I paying an LLM to get access to more information via a subscription model? Or if I'm not paying, how is the person that's producing the content getting paid? So I think it's a challenge. And make no mistake, we're already there, right? Like, I'm sure you guys are the same as me. Most of my search queries are actually going through LLMs because they're either default within a search browser now, Google Gemini, or they're just so available and they provide such a range of sources. I am then also spending all of my time cross-checking that and going, is this actually true? And understanding what sources are going into those results. But the world has already changed. We've already moved on. So we absolutely have to get to the bottom of that challenge. And I think that article is right. Independent publishers are going to struggle. Some of, let's be honest, you know, that long tail of publishers and MFA sites are going to die, and that's not a bad thing. But independent publishers that employ journalists and produce quality information need to be protected.
And we've seen some of the larger publications have struck content licensing deals with AI giants. Do you think that independent publishers are going to follow the same path? And do you think it's a positive or negative? Sorry, loaded question.
No, I think the partnerships that have been made definitely will kind of have like from, you know, what's been happening so far, it definitely has like a lens. It's got one kind of focus. And I think it'll be important for there to be some of the independents discussing that, because the more that the AI can kind of, you know, work with the partners that they have, that just kind of creates one kind of point of view. And I think it'll be really important for these independents to still be able to have their, you know, depiction of what is happening. I think there's going to be some consistent narratives, and also when we're looking with all these kind of like LLMs, we're going to have a very easy way to just kind of draw a summary of what is happening in those articles from the partners that they have. And I think with our independents kind of getting involved in that, it's going to really change how we kind of get the headlines, and not everyone's going to read through the articles. Not everyone knows as well to unpick the kind of, you know, details that come through. And I feel like the younger generations that haven't had as much exposure to life without this are just going to take that as a source of truth, and just that's the article, when it's not necessarily might just be that kind of viewpoint that's been given by those particular partners. So I think it would be important for there to be some involvement from the independents, but I think it would be really challenging to kind of, I guess, get involved to the same degree as what the larger players are.
Yeah. It's super interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, what's going to the challenge that's facing independents is obviously how do they make their revenue models stack up? So they need that in order to survive, but in order to be able to provide that crucial role of balancing out the other content sources that are coming from much larger media businesses and companies that will be, you know, feeding most of these LLMs. So that's a real fine line, and this is where I think regulation will need to step up to the plate, because we have to find a way to make this a fair, competitive marketplace without having dominant players providing all of our news sources and information. A couple of things might happen though, and I don't know enough about how media businesses, big sophisticated media businesses, are structured to understand this, but, you know, maybe what we then might find is that journalists and journalism as an occupation becomes much more independent. Journalists now no longer, maybe in the future, work for masthead publications, but instead write articles for lots of different publications, and that's maybe one way of upholding that independent voice. But then, you know, everyone's got to be properly remunerated for that. There definitely needs to be, I think, some government regulation to assist us with that. And then the other thing that you mentioned earlier there that I think is really interesting is the point on critical thinking. You know, not everybody understands how to read something and think their way around it and ask themselves questions about whether what they're reading is propaganda and or truthful. And we were just talking before we started, before we kicked off the podcast about writing and wondering whether handwriting's going to become a dying skill and whether it's even really being widely taught in school. I think we need to, you know, from an educational point of view, we will need to go back to the basics, and schools and universities, and we'll really need to focus on teaching young people critical thinking, how to understand how to read something, detect propaganda, cross-reference sources. You know, we will really, really need those skills, because the sources from which we're receiving information won't necessarily be obvious. Their biases won't be obvious.
Yeah, you can't trust the first thing that you read. And I definitely think there's some regulation, as you said, that needs to kind of be implemented there.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's move on to our third story for this week. The bosses of the UK's public service broadcasters, including the BBC, ITV and Channel 4, have rejected the idea that they would be better off if they were merged to compete with streaming giants like YouTube and Netflix. In discussion at the Royal Television Society's Cambridge Convention, they said that consolidation would harm the UK's television industry, reducing choice of viewers and the number of content buyers in the market. Ali, do you agree that the broadcasters are better off remaining separate?
I think remaining separate to a degree. So I think there is still a lot of value in having the individual broadcasters, but I think that they should kind of connect and become a bit more of like not a governing body, but like connected in a way that they can help kind of fuel what is going on outside of the streaming kind of landscape. So in Australia, we kind of had the, you know, the big four players, and they had been teasing for ages to kind of connect together and just kind of sell their inventory collectively. They were still going to have their own kind of pieces of content. They were still going to have their own things, but they would then just kind of flight them accordingly. So they might have, you know, the tentpole across one of the channels, not conflicting with others, and just kind of have it play out in a bit more of a easier way. Whereas, you know, we had these new players coming in, there was more kind of advertising opportunities starting to come out with people like Netflix introducing ad-funded models. So they were thinking about that. And I personally think when I approach kind of like a CTV campaign, I'm thinking about this as CTV for anything that's on your TV screen. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking, oh, I need a Netflix line on my plan. I need a, you know, ITV or whatever I need on the plan. I'm thinking about the overall screen's experience. And I think that's something that some of these broadcasters should be kind of coming together on, because having this inventory collectively, or even just those broadcasters in market, having an aligned front, I think will make it easier to kind of integrate them into our screens strategy, because not all of them will operate with particular partners and there's a lot of restrictions that come in. So if there was a consistent approach, I think it would make a much better opportunity for them to keep competitive with these streaming partners. And there's also things like ad pods. So each like partner has different ad pods and there's more time that goes into each. And I think that if we had a consistent experience across that, across the broadcasters, that would also then help to even kind of solidify their presence when we're looking at comparing them to the subscription-based partners that are a bit more rigid with what goes on in terms of ad pods sometimes.
Mm. Do you find from a client point of view that that's how clients are looking at their TV spend too? Like what's I just want to dedicate this budget to screens and please advise me on the best way to do that.
They're starting to.
Yeah.
And it's still like a bit of a complex landscape because historically within agencies, we've got, you know, AV teams that would be planning those things. And then we've got programmatic teams. We've got digital teams. We've got a few different kind of chefs in the kitchen with each got a different kind of angle to approach. But then clients are starting to say, why do we have three different people trying to put the same plan together? Why have we got, you know, all these lines that are doing the exact same thing but bought in different ways?
Yeah.
So I think there's more questions being asked that clients not necessarily coming saying we just want to have a CTV or a screen strategy, but that's how I'm approaching any new campaign that comes through. And when you have the autonomy for clients, I would rather position it as CTV, even including YouTube, including kind of all of our partners that we can, because that is how, you know, a user experiences it.
Yeah. That's super interesting, right? Because I think if all those broadcasters were listening to you saying that, they'd be thinking, oh, okay, TV buying's about to change. And so
I'm maybe getting ahead of myself. But,
yeah,
you know.
but it's really interesting,
yeah.
Right? Because I thought looking at this story, like, I could see some, well, you know, consolidation's not always a good thing for competition and for whoever is buying, if you think of it that way. But there's definitely some obvious upsides for broadcasters, but only to a point, because a bit like publishers, they will all want to maintain their own individual brands and identity because they're all known for something a little bit different. Sure, they might be competitors, but you know that you're going to get slightly different content on the BBC versus ITV versus Channel 4. And they all feel very strongly about their independence and their, in fact, they're probably bound by some legislative charter that they've got to provide, a certain volume of independently sourced content to be qualified as a public broadcaster. So, you know, I'm sure they all feel really passionately about that. And so then I was sort of thinking, well, what's the real benefit to them? And actually the benefit is being able to be considered in the TV plan in the way that you've just described, right? So being less siloed and being more unified in some way so that they can appeal to the modern TV buyer because things are changing.
Yeah, exactly. And like they can still have their independence, and from a consumer perspective, we don't know any different. I think it's just the way that they can kind of connect together moving into this landscape. They can be all entirely be separate entities, but just have that kind of cohesion about how to kind of build the best approach for screens and TV.
Yeah. And because if you think about it, the way that we consume TV these days is, as you say, on a single screen of some description, you know, whether that is a mobile phone or your TV at home or whatever, or a laptop. And the point is, well, we must already be in a world, if you think about young people, where they don't give a shit who's produced this and who the broadcaster is. They just want to be able to watch the end product, right? So all of that, that kind of broadcasting, that traditional broadcasting approach isn't going to mean that much to the modern consumer. And so the TV buying landscape is going to have to change as a result. Having said all of that, there's obviously all the other stuff that goes into it, which the article, you know, raised around production costs, innovation, you know, all of that. It got me wondering whether Hollywood studios were built out of a desire to challenge the status quo from mainstream broadcasters. And so I did a little bit of research, but apparently that wasn't the case. Apparently it was just because there were great tax breaks over in California in the 30s and 40s. And so that's how Hollywood studios got set up. It was cheaper to film things there than it was anywhere else. But, yeah, it gets you thinking about those sorts of things, right? Because I've always said Netflix had to go ad-funded because they put so much money into production and that is not cheap. So in order to afford that, they would have to have an ad-funded model. And this is what all broadcasters now have to keep up with. And also one other thing, sorry that I thought of with some, who can compete with YouTube these days? I mean, YouTube is just phenomenally massive and overtaking everything.
Yeah, well, like there's broadcast quality content on YouTube. Broadcasters are shifting to listing their content on YouTube exclusively. They have such like, I think there's like 26 million subscribers in the UK across all the different broadcasters that have channels on YouTube. So people are consuming so differently. And I feel like no one sits down at 6 p.m. to watch the news like they used to. So I think that's changing, and the way that YouTube has a stake in that, I think, is quite interesting to see they're already kind of adapting and broadcasters are shifting their attention towards it. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, apparently no one sits down to watch. Like, certainly I don't, and I think no one does. But whenever I say things like that, people go, oh, no, there's still loads of people that do that. There's still loads of older people. There's still... And then sometimes when I'm back in Australia, I think that TV consumption habits are a little old-fashioned sometimes. I mean, obviously, especially amongst my parents, but, you know, even amongst my peers, I'm like, oh, you guys still, like, watch linear television, like, via a linear channel? That's really weird. So I agree with you, Ellie. I do think that none of us consume TV like we used to, but there's still lots of legacy bits and pieces in there, and the wheels of change can be slow around that. And partly because broadcasters own the rights for lots of elements of the stuff that they produce. And so they get to decide where it gets shown and how it gets shown.
Yeah. No, everyone's habits are completely different. And there's definitely something to watch here and seeing what is actually going to happen with this. But yeah, I think we can wrap it up there. We're running over time. But thank you so much for the great conversations today. Ellie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Rachel, as always, thank you for guesting.
My pleasure.
And that's it for the MadTech podcast this week. And tune in next week.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.